chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
You're drowning and I throw you a life jacket. Would you grab it? Yes, good. Pick up 200 shares. I won't let you down.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
Ask them how they'd like to see 30, 40% returns. What are they going to say? No? I don't want to see those returns?
Where's the money, Lebowski?
You're going to make a lot of money, right?
Be aggressive. Learn how to push.
Show them a 3% return, and I'll trust you to watch his kids for the weekend.
I'm a big fan of money.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I did not know this.
That's it. I'm done.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 13, NASDAQ Futures up 98. As we continue to cheer for our new Fed chairman, who's going to throw money at the system and make rich people even richer and screw the hell out of the rest of us, which appears to be the plan. I don't know if it's a plan outright, but it sure looks like that's where we're heading. Well, but we got that going for us. Plus, we got Detroit still in the playoffs. I think that game last night was kind of a do or die for both of those teams. And Detroit ended up winning. I think they had the better team to start the year. I don't know if they do now. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, Detroit ended it for Matt Eberflus 2 years in a row.
Well, I don't know why there's such a hard-on for Matt Eberflus, but there is, evidently.
Well, I don't know that he's a bad guy or anything, but my, he was a god-awful coach.
Well, he was a savior when he got here.
I don't know that he was. I think a lot of people felt like he was a puzzling choice in the first place, especially considering some who were available. But nevertheless, things have worked out okay.
Well, the guy from Detroit who was going to come back and try and save him, the center retired, didn't pass the physical, eh? You see that?
That could be a problem when you have to play football.
What, I didn't read or see anything about that. I mean, you do get the idea that people retire for a reason, right? whether it's physical, mental, or you just don't want to do it anymore. But I guess I'm not surprised. But what do we?
Well, let's put it this way: how many athletes quit before they have to? Once in a while, you
once
get
in
your
a while. Well, we mean when they a lot of baseball players don't necessarily have to. They just say, "I'm not as good as I was, and I don't want to do it anymore," or whatever. But
I think they wait until they're pretty well diminished. You know, until
it's
obvious that they don't have they can't catch up to the fastball anymore. You know whatever it is. In football, I can think of Barry Sanders. I can think of Jim Brown. But they're. There really aren't very many. Most athletes, they're very competitive people. That's what makes them successful, is they're incredibly competitive. And just walking away from that is very difficult.
Well, I mean, now in softball, you can go from, like, outfield to the mound.
I'm sorry, Tom, I don't ever remember you in the outfield.
I didn't say I did. I'm saying you some could. But I was an okay first baseman and went to the mound. Of course, the thing about moving to the mound is it has to be, your pitcher has to be the guy who's there every day. You know, so I figured I'm the most reliable guy we have. I might as well be the pitcher.
Might as well be the pitcher. Well, I sort of measured my softball career in stages that, you know, and the aging in my softball career as going from always go from first to third on a single to, damn, it's getting close at third base on the when going from first to third on a single to, oh, you're occasionally out going from first to third on a single to getting halfway between second and third and saying, what in the hell was I thinking? And then the final stage is just stop at second.
Well, I think it somewhere in my early 40s, and I was never very good at it, I stopped sliding.
Never. Never willing to give up an out, even if it hurts.
And I just wouldn't.
Playing on Chicago parks, there were a lot of.
That's what I mean. I didn't. Stop going where I might have to slide. Let's put it that way. Once in a while, if it was a one you really needed, but by and large, you're like, I'm not doing this much anymore. It's after I see a couple guys break ankles too, I didn't need that.
Yeah, for listeners who don't understand what the Chicago softball parks are like, they are seldom well groomed. So when you get a really hot summer and that ground bakes, it gets really hard, and then you just get a layer of dust on top of it. So it's like somebody spread a layer of dust on your driveway, and you said, go ahead and slide.
Well, you sort of retired before me, because I'm going to say Well, we won the championship at Horner Park 2016. So I'm going to say 2012. They changed all the infields with this other stuff where it actually was soft all the time. So sliding really wasn't that much of an issue. But the issue was, especially if you were a person doomed to contact lenses, if you had any wind, the dust was incredible. But the fields, they dried out real fast, and they didn't have the stones and all that stuff on them. So for safety purposes, they were way better than when you and I were younger. But boy, oh boy, if it was windy, man, oh man, you're taking
part of the eyes. Huh?
Yeah, well, it was bad anyway. But if you were contact lens wearer, man, it was somewhat brutal. Well, Kevin, I listened to two people. I don't know how, I didn't mean to do this, but I was digging into the YouTube, and evidently they had a private showing, I guess, for lack of a better term, to some members of the Congress committee regarding this boat that got blown up, right? And it is astounding to me the difference in how people can watch the same thing and come up with the same. And you know, it's a theme that Lou brought up when he first came on the show, that we have a generation or two of people. Did he use the term, you're a moral relativist? You get to make your own morality as you go. Now, I don't know if it's because, you know, people didn't have nuns in class or whatever the hell the deal was, but, or people didn't go to church or whatever, but two guys come out, and I don't know, one's a Democrat and one's a Republican. So the Democrat comes out and he says, well, you know, someday the general public is going to see this video. This is the one where evidently we the U.S. of A, hit this boat coming up here, and it blew it up, but there were some guys evidently who were still alive. And went back and blasted the boat again. Now, whatever. I'm just, that appears to be factual. Why and how and whether it was right or wrong, that's obviously open for debate. So the Democratic guy comes out and he goes, it was one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen. I hated watching it. He goes, I can't believe we did that. So this Republican guy comes out, Tom Cotton, who looks like, you know, he's going to speak the party line like if it was wherever. Well, I saw it. It looked to me perfect. Those guys, they were trying to right the ship and restart it or something along those lines. I don't care if we'd hit them four times to kill them. And I'm sitting there going,
well, Cotton's also, he's going to give you the veteran's point of view on that too, which is when we start the mission, we're going to finish the mission. And, you know, again, right or wrong, I don't want us out attacking, you know, boats. We're kind of cloaking this in we're at war and we're not. And I don't think we've pulled this kind of crap since the you know, the Obama administration in Libya and some of the drone attacks that he did in countries that were off the battlefield in the Middle East. And I didn't like it then, and I don't like it now.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like we have a succession of people who all of a sudden think when you get that job, you have this thing where you can now decide when people live or die. And to a certain extent, you do. But I think that's my definition. I'm no constitutional scholar, but my definition you know, it says right there somewhere, I mean, only Congress can declare war. And I think, of course, I wasn't there, and I'm surely no scholar, that what that means is when you decide you're going to go out and kill people, and there are times when, obviously, it's, you know, we didn't start it, we didn't whatever. I mean, there are times when you need kind of an awful lot of people agreeing with you before you do that. That's to me where the nut case of this is. We've had kind of a succession of presidents, some, you know, different than the others, that sort of think that's all kind of on them. And I don't know about that, Kevin. I mean, whoever it is, I think
they all have some short-term abilities, but ultimately they are supposed to go back to Congress, and they never do.
Yeah, and I would just, if it was me, I mean, if I'm, you know, maybe I'm always going to be tarred with the brush of you know, the son of a Southside Catholic policeman, that if I'm going to stop a car for something and somebody's going to get hurt, I better pull the friggin' evidence out of there and say, this is why I did it. I don't just say that car looks bad to me and I'm going to blow it up. I don't know. It's just this. It's not. I hope we stop doing this somehow. I mean, soon. And you know, I don't know how we. I was talking to somebody last night, and they said the Coast Guard is actually incredibly good at this, and their story is that they come up and they have sharpshooters on the boat, and if people don't stop, they are able to kind of nail the back end of the boat and the engines and disable the craft, with the intention at least of gathering the evidence and arresting the people. And to me, that sounds exactly like you're supposed to do it. Now all of a sudden we've decided we're not doing that at all. We're just going to, somehow we have intelligence that this boat's carrying, well, and why we continue to say it's fentanyl when it's cocaine, I have no idea, but that appears to be the story. We're still saying that, even though cocaine's not, you know. But this whole thing, it's always been kind of a blur to me, Kevin, because when I was on the trading floor, cocaine was all over the place. Not on the floor, but it was a big deal back in the 80s. And if you wanted sex, you better have the blow. I mean, that's just the way the world was. And not that you had to have it, but the point being is, it was a big deal back then, and I knew people that, a guy ran for the board with me, and his wife was so into it that they had ended up with this horrible divorce, and he said she was like, what was Ike's last name? Ike and Tina.
Ike Turner.
He said she could put her finger up her nose and go right through the other side, because she totally blew out whatever membrane that is in the back of your nose, which coke will do. If we want to stop it, we better start nailing the users, Kevin. Just like when you wanted to stop street prostitution, they started putting the pictures up of the guys. I mean, with this idea that we're going to be blowing boats, all it does is raise the goddamn price. Doesn't anybody know that?
So you have to stop on the demand side. You can also stop on the supply side. How have we done on drug interdiction? Remember the war on drugs in the 80s? So it is kind of a... It's this silly exercise we do. I don't know what would happen if we just stopped. Would it be worse? Would it be better? I don't know. It is a scourge in poor neighborhoods, as well as wealthy people. So the wealthy people are the ones that you're talking about busting. But you know, when you get into the poor neighborhoods, if you're poor in the first place and you're also drug dependent, your chances of getting out of poverty, which were already not great, are way worse.
Well, I think, so, and boy, I'm no doctor, yeah. But I want your opinion on this. I think there's a difference. our buddies in school, I think there's a difference between, there's a difference between booze, marijuana. Now, I don't like the fact that that's legalized, and I smell it every time I walk down the sidewalk down here, and people are driving high. That and this fentanyl or this Oxycontin, I don't think you can come back from those, Kevin. I mean, I hope you don't see it in your neck of the woods as much as I see it here. And I still drive through some of the bad neighborhoods, some of the lower class neighborhoods, and I see people walking along that, to me, I look at them and they got to be in their 30s. They look like they're 60. They weigh like 100 pounds. They've got to be Oxycontin or fentanyl users. Cocaine didn't do that to people. Neither does marijuana. You can come back from that. This other stuff, I somehow think you have to interdict that. Even if it's bloody, because you're ruining an entire generation of people that somehow the rest of us are either going to have to watch die or take care of. I don't know how I see people walking by on the sidewalk. I don't see how the hell Dr. Mark, as good as he is, and 15 others like him, I don't see what a six-month program you get that person back normal. For God's sake, their teeth are falling out. I mean, everything. It's not like a little bit of cocaine at all. I mean, I don't know what the difference is in the drugs. I've never taken any of them. But to me, One, you better stop. And the other, you know, it'll be nice to stop. Let's put it that way. Am I totally wrong on this? But that stuff, I think, is so deadly. Remember,
I have seen, I used to live with, in when I lived in the suburban Chicago, with a bunch of commodity traders. So, and on the block, and I saw lives ruined. I saw people who make a hell of a lot of money and had a nice lifestyle and a nice family, who found themselves waking up in a crack house one day. Addiction is devastating, no matter where you go. And, you know, alcohol can be just as devastating. Yep. Alcoholism can be just as devastating as any other drug. Marijuana is interesting, but I actually knew somebody who just was, when if he was around marijuana, he was so emotionally addicted to it, or psychologically addicted to it, that he just would tighten up and had to run, because he had been through rehab, and he just said, you know, somebody gets out of joint, I got to get out of here, because I just cannot say no to that stuff.
Well, I will. This is as sort of the same thing, but it seems like if our society, if the bleeps in charge, nobody wants to hear anything bad about this marijuana stuff. Because it's income now. It's like once they had the cigarette settlement, and the state was making money from it, all of a sudden, just about all the stuff about you shouldn't smoke stopped, didn't it? But I'll tell you what is absolutely devastating.
I still see it, but yeah.
You know what's devastating and nobody wants to talk about? This gambling stuff. It's absolutely brutal, especially in some of these. I mean, I can't. You know, the scratch off lottery ticket now, the highest price is now $50. I walk into my Myers store last Sunday at 7 in the morning when I'm there, but I'm thinking by myself. Some guy walks in and he buys four $30 ones and four $20 ones. So we're talking.
Did he win?
No. Well, I don't know. He walked out the screen. I didn't stick around, but I'm thinking, there's a quick $200 on a Sunday morning. What does the guy do for a living? It's got to be a day's pay, for God's sake. Maybe not a day's pay, but what are we doing here? Do these guys know the odds? And maybe he's one of these guys that went online and found out, you know, how many winners were left in those particular ones, and, you know.
Yeah, he's at a hot deck, yes.
And, you know, maybe, I'll use the term, know what he's doing. Maybe he got the odds down from, 40% return to 60. Still, he's better off the racetrack. But, does anybody really care? It was a long time ago. Audrey lived across from this couple, and the guy was a... He worked in some factory or something. I don't know what. Nice guy. We'd go over for dinner once in a while. They were a lot older than us, I mean, at the time. And all of a sudden, the dude is not showing up. Where the hell is he? The lady goes to the bank accounts. They're all gone. The guy's living in a motel, evidently hanging out at the casino. Blew through their entire amount of cash. Where do people think this money's coming from if these go to these places?
But we feel okay about it, because at the end of the commercial we put, if you have a gambling problem, call this 800 number.
Yeah, it's fine then.
Addiction in just about any form is just devastating. And, you know, it is an area where, as we're having this conversation, that you have to agree with Trump, at least, you know what's driving him, because he lost, what was it, his brother? He lost somebody to addiction, and he's a teetotaler himself for that reason. So in that area, he just has it out for drugs and for it was opioids in the first term, it's just been big on his agenda, and it's showing up with these boat attacks, which I don't think you get to do.
No, I'm just obviously very concerned about a few things, and I actually was appalled when the guy from Saudi Arabia was in the Oval Office, and somebody asked a question about the newspaper guy who got cut up, and Trump said, "Well, you know, a lot of people didn't like the guy, and stuff happens." And I'm going, "He just didn't say that." At some point, I'm not so sure that we should, as these peace talks go forward, I don't think we give Putin the all clear on kidnapping the kids and blowing up the hospitals and stuff, do we?
Kidnapping the kids is genocide, but again, it's going to be like just about any war. If there's only two ways it's going to end, it's going to either end with one side just completely winning and taking over the other side, which I do believe, if it drags on long enough, would happen with Russia. And although we can circle back on that in a minute, but the other side of it is that you wind up with a negotiated settlement and nobody's happy with the results, and then everybody's going to fume over that for a lot of years. And so, you know, you're constantly going to have this, you know, festering boil there that sooner or later is going to burst again.
That's a problem, I think. But
I think it is a problem. It's going to be a problem with the negotiated settlement, and it's just going to take a long time, and a lot of effort to enforce it. I think the game theory behind this, though, is, and we've seen it. We saw it with the United States in Afghanistan. We saw it with Russia in Afghanistan. We saw it in Iraq. And that is, that the underdog often has a way of just outlasting the other side. You can't win. You can't win. You can't beat them. There's no way. You can't match their power. But if you can hang around long enough, inflict enough pain for a long enough period of time, sooner or later, the more powerful side just gets exhausted of it and gives up and walks away. And I think that is a tactic, and that's probably what's playing out in Ukraine.
Well, I think so too. I keep trying to remember, Kevin, but we weren't. I knew what was going on, and we managed to screw a lot of people over there at the time that were helping us. When Russia was in Afghanistan, I don't really remember, or maybe I'll ask Andrew next week or something. He might remember what, or Lou might. What was the sequence of events that had Russia pull out of there? Was it regime change in Russia first, or was they pulled out, and then because it was such a fiasco, then regime change came after? Why can't I seem to say that this morning? Do you remember the sequence of events, sir?
No, offhand, I don't. I don't remember. Was it Yeltsin, or
I think it was Yeltsin that had him in there, and Gorbachev took him out, or something? I'm not positive. And then we ended up, our legacy over there was we were funding all these guys to basically piss Russia off. One of them was Osama bin Laden, and he ended up turning against us, and because we kind of ditched on those guys, because I don't know what we're going to do with them. But
I don't think it was that as much as I don't think he was ever fond of us.
But he took money to fight the Russians.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And I don't know what. Well, he didn't like the.
Thanks, chump.
Well, he didn't like the his big bitch was against his buddies in Saudi Arabia. They're stealing all the money from everybody else, which he was sort of right about on that, wouldn't you say? I mean, what he was a member of the royal family, wasn't he, or a distant guy?
I think he was the royal family, but I think he was a member of a connected family.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he was a prince or anything, but he didn't like the Saudi people. Because they steal all the money. There seems to be a lot of that going on, eh? In Russia, a few people steal all the money. Here, it seems like we got a few people stealing all the money. When are we going to...
You keep saying plutocracy when maybe what we're talking about is a kleptocracy.
Well, I think that's how you get there. Right? I mean, it's... for those that don't know what we're talking about, the term plutocracy essentially means government by... The governing and the rich people kind of control everything. Very similar to the nobles back in the Middle Ages, right, Kevin? Where the we're seeming like we're sort of heading there here, and I don't, and the funny part is people keep talking about the alternative is socialism by people that I don't even think can define socialism. But I think one of the most interesting things that's happened in the show for a while is Hal digging up. What did he say? He was rereading Karl Marx in a totally different light, and everybody looks at, you know, Das Kapital, and you look at the I guess what came out afterward, which was communism or something, designed really by Lenin, not by Marx. And Hal Snar went back and essentially went back to the roots of the whole thing. And what was Karl Marx really pissed off about? And he was pissed off essentially by the few people had all the dough, the noble slash the same kind of system that we're heading towards here, is what Karl Marx... It wasn't like Karl Marx started out to be a communist or anything. He was railing against, according to Hal, was railing against the ridiculous system there was, which is pretty much the same system everywhere, right? I mean, you had your the Hohenzollerns were in Germany, and the Habsburgs were in Austria, and a whole bit of different groups, right? And the Romanovs were in Russia. And he was railing against a few people with their nose up the ass, basically a government, which is kind of right where we're heading, isn't it? And not just this administration. He's only been there a year. As much as you may not like or like the guy, the fact is he didn't do this. He may be pushing it along pretty fast, but it was not his invention, was it?
No, we've been on this road for a long time. And, you know, it's interesting because in some ways you're seeing it continue. In other ways, though, it's a different group of who's on the ins and who's on the outs. I think you've seen the people. First of all, you've seen a lot of these tech leaders who have morphed into different people all of a sudden. So that they are displaying an uncanny ability to just be somebody else, whatever they need to be to thrive. And we've all seen people like that in the business world. So. Who were really, really good at taking care of themselves. But, I think Gates has lost a lot of influence. I think that, the whole World Economic Forum approach has lost some influence. So we'll see how that continues. But boy, if you were to back up that train just a couple of years, that would have been the most influential group in the world at that point.
Well, but you have, whenever you have this stuff,
even Gates is backing off of the climate change agenda.
Yeah, well, I mean, but even here in Chicago, you have, this is kind of the progression. I mean, there were always people on the trading floor that had more money and were bigger traders than other people, but they were kind of just traders, all right. And all of a sudden now, and you had, it was a. I mean, talk about a group. It was probably almost like a group of professional athletes. Everybody was very proud that it was competitive. Everybody was proud to be doing what they were doing. And there were a few people always that were sleazebags, but basically everybody else took care of them or didn't let them be too big of sleazebags. But then you have all of a sudden these changes really brought about by the bigger firms. They didn't want to deal with a bunch of market makers. They wanted, back to almost like the specialist system in New York where, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, only worse. So now you have these four or five firms, one of which is bigger than just about anybody, and you squeeze everybody out of the business, and all of a sudden you're rich beyond but now all of a sudden you not only are rich because you managed to screw with an industry, and instead of a whole bunch of people making money, you got a few people making money, and everybody else works for them, which is a very European model. Now all of a sudden these guys think that they're policymakers, that all of a sudden... Now, they should be running the world, not just their industry. And I don't know if it's a natural thing, but these people think that they're the movers and shakers of the world, and it's kind of a different skill set. And I don't know even where a solid politician comes from right now. I mean, if you don't take money from these guys, you don't get anywhere. So you almost become the lapdogs of these people, even though you're not doing it. I mean, I would find it... And I'm going to say, Kevin, I'm going to include you in this. If you and I ran 5-6 times in a row and unabashedly took some huge check from wherever it was, we'd have maybe not problems voting against something that impacts that industry in the wrong way, say drugs, say insurance, whatever it is. I think we would probably never all of a sudden start that legislation. I mean, we may... at the end of the day, vote against our sacred cow, but I don't think it would be on our number one agenda to take them down, would it?
Well, I think people get enticed into that. what do I always say? How does it happen? Slowly and then suddenly. I do think a lot of people they just get corrupted very slowly, a little piece at a time, and I don't necessarily mean illegal corruption or dishonest corruption, although that can be part of it too. And God knows you're seeing all this stuff going on in Minnesota that is just outright, you know, stealing. Among the politicians, it's like, you know, there I am, I'm in, and I have this opportunity, I'm going for it. But I think you see a lot of people who believe they're doing good work, that believe they're supporting the right things, even though it can be a little the process can be a little distasteful in their minds. There's a whole rationalization that goes with this that is, that is really, I think, endemic in the system. It's one of the great arguments for term limits. Yes, don't let people get far enough down the road.
As you know, I always push back on that because there's always a workaround. There's always a workaround. You start paying people sooner. I mean, I don't know. I actually don't know the answer, but I part of it also is, Kevin, and you know, goes back to a question, and I remember this one because it was quite a question. Somebody asked George Stigler in a class, and he was a governmental Nobel Prize-winning economist, and he said, how can you stop corruption in Chicago? And he goes, I can stop it tomorrow. The kid goes, how the hell are you going to do that, basically? And when I say kid, these are graduate school people. And he goes, well, you've got this system where you've got, let's just say, the alderman or the mayor. He says, let's just say the alderman. And this is in the mid-70s. So he goes, the guy makes 10 grand a year, and the mayor makes 40 grand a year because you think they're stealing or having something on the side. Okay, then they got something on the side, and you're pissed off at them. He goes, well, you sort of can't have it both ways. He goes, if you want, I could stop. He's the mayor, and he knew every, I forget what it was, but he knew every statistic, of course, has how many thousand people working for him, and his budget is X. He goes, that's bigger than the budget and the amount of people that work for, let me say, Ford or somebody at the time. He goes, here's what the chairman of Ford makes. He makes like 10 times what your mayor makes. He goes, so what are you trying to do here? He's if I could stop it tomorrow, I could have the mayor make $1 million a year. And everybody in the class like, ugh. And he goes, but I'll put $950 of it in escrow. And every year for the next 20, he gets to, that he's not indicted on something, he gets to draw the dough. And but if he's ever indicted, he forfeits it all. Or if he's convicted of any shenanigans, he forfeits the dough. He goes, what are you doing? And I think somewhere in Congress, I mean, I think a lot of people, and I'm in this group, Kevin, because I've told you 100 times, in private and in public, I don't know what $1 trillion means. I mean, I have no idea. I mean, if you drop $1 billion, could you even drop it on the studio desk here? Or do you need the whole room? I don't even know. I have a lot of clients that have, you know, several $1 million, but I don't know. I've yet to get the guy with the billion, let alone the trillion. So, but I mean, I think you somehow, unless you're Solomon or you know, the Virgin Mary or someplace. When you see the amount of money that you give out to people in these jobs, and you see, you know, what one contract from the Senate or the House of Representatives or the City Council gives out to people, you sit there and go, what the bleep am I doing making 40 grand a year sitting here handing out stuff to other people that are making millions on the stuff I'm giving them? It is so bizarre. I mean, we've seen this with Carl's buddy that he helped elect down in Florida, and I... You know, when I went to a couple of those, Jewish things. Who's their big lobbying group?
No, you're talking about, I can't remember.
I'll think of it. AIPAC.
AIPAC, yeah.
And I think you end up with this massive turnover after a couple of terms. And then you're sort of in or you're out. Maybe that's a term limit argument, but it seems like the first couple of terms, you don't do anything anyway. You're nothing but a spectator, which is bizarre on top of it.
I think, well, which isn't 100% true either.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, we've seen a lot of a lot of young people gain influence very quickly, whether it's AOC and her group, her that squad group. They've upset a lot of apple carts real quickly.
Well, but I'm saying in general, unless you have a group, if you just get elected, you're lucky to get the last ass on the crummiest committee. You're lucky to get the crummiest office, and they just tell you to vote this way or the next way. I don't think you're involved in anything. Now, she is essentially campaigning all the time. She's like little Trump in that regard. And she never stops. Yeah. I get a letter from her every day.
She's good at publicity.
Well, but she's...
You get one, I don't. That's another example of you not being in the middle. You're on their list.
I don't know how the hell I got on her list. But you know what the scary part is, Kevin? She reminds me so much of Trump. Every letter is the incredible thing she did to get elected. It sounded exactly like Trump in the first term. Every time he opened his mouth, all he did was talk about beating Hillary. Half the letter, I've not seen one yet that has any policy in it. Every one of it is, keep this revolution going. You got to give me money because look who I beat. Look at the incredible upset it was. It sounds like she took Trump's letters from his first term and just and sent them to me.
Yeah.
How scary is that?
You also get the grift. But let's go back on who's really calling the shots. And you've seen Chinatown, and if any of our listeners haven't seen Chinatown, it's a great movie on its own merits as with the intrigue and everything in it. But there's a great exchange between Jack Nicholson as Jake Gittes and Noah Cross, who is played by John Huston. And, so Gittes says to him, "How much are you worth?" And Cross says, "I have no idea. How much do you want?" And so Gittes says, "I just want to know what you're worth. More than $10 million? And he says, "Oh, my, yes." And remember, this is taking place a long time ago.
When $10 million was $10 million.
When $10 million was a lot of money.
Yeah.
So why are you doing it? How much better can you eat? What could you buy that you can't already afford? Do you remember what he said?
Actually, I don't.
He said, "The future, Mr. Gittes." Yeah. He used to call him Mr. Gittes instead of Gittes. Mr. Gittes, the future. That's what he can buy. That's what people like Gates. That's what, that's what the World Economic Forum group is all about.
Well, I keep talking about...
It's partly the accumulation of personal wealth, but it's personal wealth so that you can guide the future because you know better than what the rabble knows.
Well, and there's two kinds of that, I think. One is the Bill Gates side, and I'm no fan of this.
I'm using him as an example. He's probably one of the biggest examples, but he's not the only one.
Okay, but I'm saying to me, I've come across seemingly two kinds. One is he leaves the business, allegedly, and has buku bucks. How much is buku, Kevin? Is that a big? Is there a specific number? He has a lot of money. He has buku bucks, and now he wants to...
I thought it was boku, but go ahead.
Yeah, whatever.
Buku sounds closer, dirty.
Close enough. It's early in the morning.
But buku sounds dirty. It sounds like you're doing something, some bad sex act.
You jealous?
No.
So, anyway, speaking of which, I've said a few times, I probably should have, that people are disappointed they can't... they can't invent a new fetish. You can't invent something dirty that people haven't done before. I might be wrong. This truck came by me the other day. It was a delivery truck.
Yeah.
Guess what it said on the back?
What?
It was flowerfetish.com.
Flowerfetish.com. Okay. So there you go.
And these guys.
Well, as you say that too, I am willing. I am absolutely willing to try to invent a new fetish.
Well, yeah. But anyway, there's the Bill Gates side. And I'll say he comes out, and all of a sudden he's got, even though he apparently went to Epstein's Island or someplace, or he went did something where the wife dumped him, but his idea is, well, I'm in on his global warming, and I'm in whatever it is. Now, sometimes people pick a disease. A lot of people spend a lot of money on, and the stuff is really, I think it's heart tugging, bringing all these kids from Africa here. They have that the cleft palate thing or something. They get them fixed here and bring them home. I mean, doing something like that, for God's sake, my hat's off to you. Some guys go that direction, but the other guys that are still in business, I'll use the Harold Janine model, and for those that don't know, Harold Janine was the chairman of ITT, which is generally considered the world's biggest world's first international conglomerate. Is that a fair statement, Kevin?
Yeah, international
telephone and telegraph.
The telegraph was what I'm trying to remember. Remember that when we had telegraphs.
Well, they laid all the cable in the bottom of the Atlantic where you could telegraph Europe, and which became telephone Europe and blah, 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 long before satellites. And his view was, I deal with all these countries all the time. These politicians are maybe, on their best day, half as smart as me. People like me should be running the world. Now, that's a whole different view, I think, than Bill Gates. I mean, I don't know if I'm splitting hairs here.
I think that's exactly the view of Bill Gates.
But, I mean, he never really did it while he was at... Well, maybe he did. I'm saying I put the guy at NVIDIA in Janine's category more than I do Bill Gates. Bill Gates, to me, just ran the place until he quit and then started doing all his stuff.
He started doing the foundation, but he's also been accumulating, you know, farmland and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. So he's not... He hasn't stepped away from business. He's just a little more under the radar now in terms of what he's doing from a business standpoint.
But I'm saying, I think there's somewhat of a difference, and you think that your firm is really smarter than all the governments, and you want to... That's where I put this... I wouldn't trust this NVIDIA guy as far as I could throw him. I never met the man, but it seems to me he's playing us against China, and Trump might be the Rube in this one. I think he and the Chinese guy are winning, but that's another story.
Yeah, you know what? I haven't actually sat down, you know, seen him do a sit down interview with.
I think he wants no part of that, Kevin.
I think there's probably something out there. I need to look for that because I would like to see, you know, again, people can go on an interview and lie. That's not what I'm getting at. But when you start to see long form interviews, you know, where you see people just sit down for an hour with somebody. If you that was sort of the beauty of the Rogan podcast during the campaign is if you're going to get follow up questions in a long form like that, you're going to get them. I mean, you know, it's not all softball stuff. And when you sit down with somebody in the case of Rogan, it's generally about 3 hours. But you know, even Andrew Schultz was for you know a little over an hour. These are the kinds of things where you do have to reveal something, and you may be lying your ass off. But
well, I think they do.
While you're doing it, though, it starts to look pretty transparent. You have a good chance to see through it.
That's why they're politicians. But I mean, the whole point of Janine's view of the world was, okay, I'm doing business in the United States. This Biden's a chump. This Trump's a chump. This Obama's a chump. I give money to the other side. I try and get them the hell out of there, or I wait it out 8 years, or 4 years or 8 years. And their time horizon is so much different. It is so much different. I mean, I have very personal experience with that on the CBOE floor. When the options exchange started, the member firms hated it because it was a open outcry system. They didn't control it. They were just a member. They just got to do business there. They hated it. The people that controlled the New York Stock Exchange, the guys who were behind the specialists. And this started in 73. And it wasn't until probably 2000 and something that they totally gained control and got it their way. They never dropped, Kevin. A guy like me got on the board. They'd back off for a year or two, but they were always there. They just kept pushing until finally one day there is no CBOE in any stretch of like a competitive system like it used to be. Everything, and now they get money getting back from people. Everything that the CBOE was designed to do, a fair and orderly market, we don't do now. But they never backed up. But their time
You know what you're describing? This is exactly what we talked about back at the beginning when we said, how's Ukraine trying to fight the Russians?
Yeah.
You just outlast them.
Well, I mean, but these guys, you could just tell that when it wasn't the politically proper time, they would back off a few years and those guys would be gone and some new guys would be in. And all of a sudden, things changed. And I think that's what happens in a lot of the government stuff. I think that the last, you know, we have, I think between all the group people we have on the show, I'm so somehow or another, I don't even know how it happened or how I pulled it off, but I think we have the best group of people. Some of the stuff that Hal has come through in the last 3 weeks and a lot of the courses he's teaching, I think is some of the most spectacular breakthroughs of knowledge that we've had. I mean, Carl always comes up with something unique. I mean, but you almost expect it from him, basically. But with Hal, it's This whole thing about the banking thing, I kind of suspected that. You know, Kevin, how this stuff kind of rigged things against. I mean, I sensed it was harder and harder for smaller people to get loans, even if they had the collateral and everything else. But I never really put my finger on it. And all of a sudden, Hal dug this stuff up. And he's like, here's where it is. It's right here in these two laws. And I didn't know that. I mean, somebody's behind all this crap. And who's the somebody's? Is it just you put your hand. I could remember at the CBOE, and I keep using that. It's almost like Casablanca. Nobody would ever say, God, if a member firm, does something crappy on the trading floor or steals some money with an order or does a crossing order they shouldn't. Nobody would ever say, you can't enforce any rules against these guys because they're big-time member firms. Yet, Kevin, if you walk down the hall up there, what did the guy say in a Casablanca? I put my finger up to the wind and the winds are coming from Vichy. Everybody just knew you didn't go after a member firm, especially if they had a guy on a board or something. You just knew it. And somehow I think that's permeating. You just don't go against these people. Or if you do, you get to talk about it in Congress and maybe you do it at campaign stops, but you don't really do anything. And somehow it seems like we're there. And I don't know. And Carl's absolutely right. Nobody's going to go against this drug/hospital/doctor thing, and yet it's going to break us. I don't see how it doesn't. Or else we're just going to not take care of people, one or the other.
And the amazing part of it, I think, is what a great job people do of cloaking this in I'm helping the little guy.
Yeah.
And part of your discussion with Hal is this happens way too frequently for it to be just a mistake. You know, that every time we do this legislation for the little guy and we screw them and somebody else makes a lot of money off of it instead, it can't be a coincidence anymore. One might be a coincidence. You know, 21 in a row is not.
No. And I remember my bro and I are in the same car together. We eventually come to this argument. He's still convinced that it's good people doing things for the right reasons and all of a sudden landed in the wrong spot. And I go, Dan, it doesn't happen 10 times in a row. It just doesn't. I mean, and I know we have people on the show that
let's put it this way. It defies probability.
Yes.
What is the probability that it's just random? And if you know numbers, you know, this is like, you know, all of my quality management stuff, you're just working probabilities when you start doing your analysis, and the numbers are saying that is highly unlikely to be some random event.
But I also think that even though we have people, I guess I'll accuse you of sometimes touting the media as being against one side or the other. Now I once in a while I go to YouTube. Seems to me like there's idiots on both sides. But having said that, my point is, Kevin, is that it's not necessarily about the individual people. But if you look at the general news media, and I talk, and I listen to CNBC and those kind of business stuff more than I do other stuff, so I guess that puts me in a corner. But if these guys drop the rates next week, okay, you're going to have 58 swinging idiots come out and say, this helps everybody. Your credit card rates are going to go down. This rate's going to go down. That rate's going to go down. Kevin, I did a study 2 years ago when interest rates went from 7% to 1% or something during whatever period we were in, the 10-year period, credit card rates went up. Whatever it is, whatever administration it is, they take this line. Everybody, if you talk to anybody at any library, saloon, or coffee shop, hey, if the Fed drops rates, does that drop your credit card rates? And everybody's going to say yes. No, it hasn't. It never has. They're higher than they have been. They're highest now they've ever been. I mean, what? But in general, they follow the party line, even though it's, it could be Trump, it could be Obama, it could be Biden. The fact is, there's no connection between the rates you pay and the Fed. Now, granted, if they drive them down dramatically and somehow or another the longer term goes with it, your mortgage rates may drop with the 10-year. But they also could drop them so low that the inflationary expectations go up where your mortgage rates could actually go up and not down. And yet, they'll still say on TV, oh, God, the mortgage rates are going to go down. The 10-year rate is the same as it was now as the three cuts ago. Whoever even says that on TV? I mean, we have this amazing, whether you take the part out about whether people hate Trump or people hate Biden or whatever, that group, the sniping from the sides, the simple fact is the middle of the media tells people the wrong story, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I will tell you, you know, because I know you're a CNBC guy.
I only watch it because I have to.
I understand. You know, in the mornings, I usually, when I get up, at least for a little while, I'll put on Maria Bartiromo's show. She does get guests on there that that will say a lot of the same things you're saying. Well, she also gets guests that are just, you know, spouting the line, too. But you know, I do see a lot of that on her show. So you do get a little bit different.
Okay, but let me...
You know, she also gets Kenny, so you know she's damn good.
Well, let me agree with you a bit. If you watch CNBC, these people all day, you're going to get somebody who says that. I'm talking about just in general, if you're driving along and you're listening to News Radio 78 and they come out with the announcement, Fed lowers interest rates, this should lower rates, credit card rates. The rest of the world who doesn't see the different guests that maybe Maria has or somebody on CNBC, we might get, if we listen to it all day long and we listen close, we're going to get both sides of the story. But if you're just wandering around, every man that doesn't listen to either one of those, you're going to get some buffoon or buffoonette telling you your credit card rates are going down. So I was misstating. I'm talking about if you just listen to the announcement on GN or somebody like that, that's what they're going to tell you. I don't know if you disagree with that.
And part of that is, you know, radio is a terrible form for this.
Yeah.
Because everybody's, you know, you're in the car for, you know, sometimes in Chicago, sometimes for way longer, but, you know, most people are in the car for 10 minutes, you know, going someplace, going to running an errand, doing whatever they do. And so they build their news around that. And that's not very helpful.
Did I ever tell you that back a long time ago, especially for me, I don't know about for her, back when, say, we looked a little better, I had a long conversation with Maria Bartiromo out of the swimming pool in Arizona.
Yeah, you said that. You said, yeah, you know, she's a pretty darn good-looking old bat.
Oh, pretty lady, and very bright. And she was in a white bikini, as I recall, and I was in a...
Indelibly etched into your brain, you say?
Well, no, she just, you know, she was... I mean, she wasn't... didn't have the best figure in the place, but she was pretty darn nice, and very pretty and very bright, and I didn't look so bad then either. Now I don't think I would do that in a bathing suit anymore. Just saying. I don't know if I'd give any interviews in bathing suits. Just, you know, just saying. Now then, I didn't have a problem with it, but that was then. Things change, yeah. Kevin, you know. Oh, she was very nice. She came out and did the keynotes at the Risk Management Conference, or the, I think it was the Options Industry Conference. She gave the keynote speech. She was fine. You know, they used to.
I think she's really bright. She's, you know, on her show, you know, she's very consistently in Trump's corner. So, you know, you have to understand that bias, and she's not, you know, she doesn't represent it as anything other than that. And then the other thing is she's very all over China and China's business practices and China's human rights violations, probably more so than you see most places, which, you know, I do appreciate that as a reporting, because that affects the guests she gets on there too. So, you know, that's why I said, you know, if I put it on for a half hour in the morning before I hit the shower and shave while I'm having my bowl of cereal, you know, that's you know, that's what I see, because I'm, you know, you watch CNBC because you have to. I don't have to, and you know, I get tired of it real quickly. So
well, some of the people that went to Fox, if you're not in Trump's corner, you get fired. I mean, Liz Klayman, I don't know if she's still on Fox or where she is, but
she's still on Fox Business. Yeah,
she went there, and she's a very liberal from Berkeley kind of lady. And all of a sudden, a couple times I've listened to her, she like kind of is herself for a while. At the end of the show, she has to wrap it up by saying something conservative. And I'm going, somebody must have told her to say that or something. But anyway, it's this whole idea that on one side or the other, you have to be one side or the other. I don't get, but that's what they do. But no, you know, when Maria was on the floor, New York Stock Exchange, a lot of people don't know that she was on there. She was the first newspaper person they ever were allowed on the floor, she didn't have an electronic teleprompter or anything back in those days. There was no notebook computers. There was none of that stuff. So she had the camera and she's standing there, and people would bring her stuff to say, like from the booth. Oh, this number just came out, blah, 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 blah. And people would jam stuff in her hands, and she would, you know, you're supposed to look into the camera, which she was very good at, and she's looking in the camera, and people are jamming this piece of paper, like, into her hand. Well, she didn't even look to see half the time who was jamming her the piece of paper. So sometimes she'd look down, and somebody wanting a date that night or worse. Let's say very much worse. And she'd look down.
Was she good at poker facing it?
Oh, yeah. She got really good at it. I mean, she's a girl from Jersey. You know, she's five stops down. Five exits down the track. She's not intimidated. She's a tough babe. In a good way. I mean, but I mean, she was there by herself on that floor with most of the people not liking it. And, oh, by the way, they were jamming stuff. You know, how about doing this to me tonight or something like that? The guys are doing to her. She hung in there, and all of a sudden, then all of a sudden, she had her laptop, and she didn't have to worry about that stuff. But not all of a sudden, but after many years, people forget how soon this was. I mean, when I was on the trading floor, when CNBC first came on, it was illegal to have it in the pit because people thought it gave people on the floor an advantage. You couldn't have a computer on the floor; you could have a calculator. That was it. The computers they had at the time, they were called a Mancheck Weber to get theoreticals on options. They were up in the members' lounge. You had to run upstairs if you wanted to get your theoreticals.
Interesting.
And so the only thing you would do, Kevin, is there were people, depending on the crowd you were in, there were box traders, there were butterfly traders, and reversal conversion traders. You know, you have any idea what I'm talking about?
No idea.
Well, for every option, now I can't do this in my head, I used to be able to. If you were to tell me the interest rate, the dividend, and you tell me Honeywell is trading 192.79, I'm just having to look at the middle of my screen. If you tell me what the call next week, the 200 calls are trading for next week, or the 195 calls, I can immediately back into what the put price should be. Because I know there's a relationship between the call and put, because if you're long the stock, short the call, that's essentially being short the put. It's the same position. And if you're long the put, long the stock, then it's the same thing as being long the call. Same thing. So you can back in, there's a put call parity. But also there's a price for any kind of butterfly, and there's a price for a box. Now the box is if you're long the 90 call, short the 95 call, long the 95 put, short the 90 put, that should come out to be $5 plus or minus in case there's a piece of interest or if there's a dividend. So once you know what that is, if a couple of those are trading, you can tell what the others. I mean, if you were to say, I do this for my people all the time, which is something again that I can do that most people have no clue. If you're long a put, you say, okay, I want to roll the put down because now roll the put up because it's very much in the money. I'll sit there and go, okay, well, if one's trading $15 and the other one's trading, you know, $11, I may never get that spread off. But if I look at the other side, I see the call spread's $1, I'll say, okay, the put spread should be $4 because they should equal 5, right? Because it ends up being $5. If you're long the call spread and the put spread, it's going to go out of $5, correct? I mean, I know I'm going too fast here, but are you picking up any of my drift here? You can trade.
A little bit.
Essentially, if you know that where one option is trading, you know what the interest rate is, you know what the dividend is, and you know the days to expiration. You can figure out in your head what the opposing putter call should be.
Okay.
So you actually could trade
the good math head, you can be successful.
Right. Well, that was before computers. Computers were considered an advantage that you couldn't have on a trading floor. So and now as time has gone by, these guys have all the advantages in the world, and they're proud. Yeah.
Hey, you know, real quickly, because it's time to get to Carl. Yeah. He's been hanging on the whole time anyway, and it's Carl time. Just mention that it's a good football weekend. Tomorrow, the college football is going to shake out a little, you know, probably shake out the playoff scenarios with some of these championship games. There are some teams that can gum up the works, and so we'll see how that shakes out. And then, of course, there is Bears-Packers on Sunday. So we'll, you know, it's in Lambeau. I think, you know, from the Bears' point of view, if they play the Packers twice in the next you know, twice in 3 weeks. If they can walk away from those two games with a split, they'll be in pretty good shape. But it will be a good test. And the last time they played it last January, the Bears beat the Packers in Lambeau Field. So it can happen.
This guy they got from New Orleans is a game changer. The Packers, the defensive lineman.
Oh no, from Dallas.
Dallas, Parsons or whatever. He's a man among boys. That guy.
Yeah, he is. He's absolutely terrific, and the Bears have a really good offensive line, so that'll be something to watch. That's worth seeing.
Why did you ruin my evening last night and tell me that the Notre Dame girls ran? Because I didn't get to watch the football because I refused to buy that. I watched Notre Dame girls, and that ruined my evening. I blame you.
Yeah, they're going to get exposed sometimes this year because they just don't have any depth at all. And when Prosper got herself in foul trouble the whole game, that took one of their good players off the floor. And
they also don't have anybody big. They're like the Bulls.
Yeah, and Prosper's 6'2" and freakishly long arms and all that, and a great defender. And she didn't get to play.
Yeah.
So that's going to hurt them. But yeah, so that wasn't good. Men play tonight. They're playing against TCU. Who has one of my favorite college basketball coaches. I mean, this is really a guy I like a lot, Jamie Dixon. He coached at Pittsburgh for a long time when the Irish were in the Big East. And you knew when you played Pittsburgh, whether they were sometimes near the top of the Big East, sometimes they were in the middle of the pack, but they were always tough as hell. So you knew if you beat Pittsburgh, you were doing something. And, Dixon, I think he was a pretty good guy. As coaches go, and I think well respected, and like I said, his teams were always they were a problem for everybody.
Is that how you refer to Kyle? He's a pretty good guy, as computer guys go.
Is that how I refer to who?
Carl. He's a pretty good guy, as computer guys go.
Oh, come on, guys!
A wonderful guy. Carl is an absolutely wonderful guy.
I love the way you slipped
you
that
so
in.
Full of, trying to butter my bread here just doesn't work out all that well. I'm just saying.
But yeah, I like the part he stuck in.
Nobody's going to buy it.
Well, I like the part. He was a good guy, as coaches go. What does that mean?
As coaches go, right.
So we're talking about the fourth ring of hell, not the fifth, or what?
I don't know.
We were talking about politicians earlier. And
there you go.
Yeah.
Their world is like, coaches have to navigate that same world. And, there are a few that have a lot of respect. And when I've seen some polls of who are the most honest coaches, Mike Bray was always on that list. I don't remember if Dixon was on there or not. Chris Holtman, who I believe is at DePaul now, was always one of those guys, but he was at Ohio State for a while.
Well, so is the guy in Marquette got to be, and look what they're doing. They're lousy.
Shaka Smart?
Yeah.
So you're going to see it, but I also sat in a lot of post-game press conferences when I was doing the side hustle for covering Notre Dame basketball, and there were some that I loved. Texas A&M coach, what's his name, Buzz Williams. I thought he was, he was terrific. And just to give you an example, when he was at Virginia Tech, and I remember asking him a question because it was like his second year and they had made some progress after being way down. And so my question was along the lines of, well, you've made a lot of progress. What do you see as the next steps for your program? And his first thing was, well, thank you for noticing. I really appreciate that question. And then you get a good long answer from him on that. A lot of coaches wouldn't give you that. I thought Krzyzewski was a jerk. I thought Boeheim could be a real jerk. Jim Calhoun could be a real jerk.
Well, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, but a lot of others, they were really patient. Because if you ever sit in one of these post-game press conferences, they get a lot of really, really stupid questions. Coach, how big was that shot that gave you the lead for good? Oh, it was very big.
It was very big, huh?
And a lot of them are going to, they're going to push back on that and just tell somebody, act like children, basically. And then there are coaches who will, you know, you sort of see that look on the face like, oh God. And then, you know, they'll gather themselves and try and give you something, because what people are really doing is they're saying, coach, I need a quote for my story. So that they'll try and give you something. But boy, you know, if you do ask a good question, you know, that gets a coach to talk about shop, because everybody likes to talk shop. If you ask one of those questions, then they light up and you get a really good answer.
Quick question, we'll get Carl's opinion on this too. Who decided, who in the world, like it's like the politicians, it kind of even goes with the politicians, how Jesse Jackson's kid somehow, he was in the wind for 3-4 years after he was convicted, now he's back being a representative, right? So it's kind of bizarre world, or he's running anyway. This guy from Northwestern just got hired again at Michigan State. Now, he was... Where was he? Was he in... Where do you go between heaven and... here and heaven? Was he in purgatory? Who decided...
You have to do penance. You do penance, that's all.
But, who determines how long the penance is? I mean, you know what's funny? Remember the movie Hoosiers? I'm sure you ever see that, Carl? Well, that's what happened to that guy, right? Because he smacked some kid on the sideline, and he had to go... coach a high school for 3-4 years before they brought him back? Who decided that the penance is 3 years? I mean, the guy from Kentucky that went to the little school up in upstate New York, and now he's at St. John's. What's his name? Rick?
Pitino.
Yeah. Now, was he 2 or 3 years in penance? Who determines that that's the length of time?
Sometimes it's the NCAA, because I remember sending out something last spring during the NCAA tournament, showing, you know, which coaches had the show clause thing that says you can't hire them in for the next 3 years. So they go off and they'll do their penance working as an assistant in the NBA or a scout in the NBA for a little while, and then somehow or another they find their way back, and you find yourself as the head coach at Auburn or someplace like that. That Bruce Pearl would have been an example. Calvin Sampson would be an example of guys like that. So their penances, according to the NCAA restrictions put on them, but other people's penance, I don't know. You know how Pat, what's his name from Northwestern? Pat Fitzgerald. Yeah, I think, you know, his penance was probably self-imposed. I don't know that he's been coaching anywhere else as an assistant.
Well, he got some huge settlement, didn't he?
I'm sure he did, yeah.
I think it was like $100 million for some bizarre. It was like massive dough. It might not have been that much. I'll have to look it up.
But yeah, I don't know if it was that much either. Yeah. But anyway.
All right, take care.
I got to go, so right. I'm going to turn you over to Carl. And Carl, steer the ship home for the rest.
I'm going to run it right up. No, I'm running it up on the rocks. I've had enough of this.
You're the cruise ship driver that wanted to get the look at a girl in a bikini and ran the thing aground?
I'm full speed ahead, balls to the wall. Here we go.
Our Monday morning guest, John Lee, is... get a load of this, Carl. He's taking a literature cruise on the Queen Mary 2 from New York to Britain next week.
Oh, that's interesting.
And he's going to call in from the ship.
Well, yeah, you can do that now.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
Well, you know, actually, one of the things that I think is rather amusing is that, cruise ships forever, when my daughter was much younger, we used to enjoy them because she could mostly do what she wanted and I could do what I wanted, which frequently included laying around in the hot tub with an adult beverage in my hand. And I just love being on the water. So, I mean, it's not so much that I want to go to all the shore excursions and, you know, which is all packaged touristy garbage anyway. But I just enjoy the idea of being on the ocean. And, you know, hanging out in a cantilevered, hot tub over the edge is pretty cool. Anyway, they have Wi-Fi service on the ship, but they have always been confiscatorily expensive for you to use it. And the reason is because you really don't have another option. Once you're more than 10 miles offshore, you're beyond the range of cell service. Okay? So even if you have global roaming, and that tends to be expensive, as soon as the ship leaves the port, that doesn't work anymore. Okay? So So your only real option is to pay them because they've got a captive audience. There's, you know, there's 2,500 people on board. But their systems were frequently screwed up enough that if you had a little bit of brains, you could figure out how to get through their firewall without having to actually pay them, which was rather cute. These guys did not have rocket scientists in their IT department. But that game's gone now, and here's the reason. Starlink works anywhere, okay? And the Mini is small enough, I have one, that you could stick that sucker in your carry-on bag along with a modest 12-volt power supply and have several hours sitting on the, you know, on the outside deck. I mean, it has to have a view of the sky, right, in order to work. But now, Musk charges more for global roaming service as opposed to, you know, inside the United States, and it knows where you are, so you can't get away with trying to cheat that one. Because it's kind of obvious where it is, right? I mean,
if you're in the middle of the ocean and only a few spots you can be, you got to be on something.
Well, no, the network knows exactly where you are from a triangulation. It has to in order to work. Okay, so it is going to pop up and basically say, hey Jackwad, you know, this is going to cost extra money. Okay, fine, but it's going to be considerably cheaper than what the cruise ship wants to charge you. So now all of a sudden there's this problem because there isn't anything illegal about carrying one of those things around. It's your personal electronics. It's fine. And it's not dangerous. It's not hazardous material or whatever have you. So I suspect that now that that's the case, these guys have put several of these things on the ships and the price is coming down, because if not, that's exactly what people like me are going to do.
Well, he's already done this once. He did it last year, and I said, John, what you're talking about the North Atlantic in December? He said it was 50 degrees the whole way across, and he's expecting that this year. But this winter didn't seem the same way. But people,
well,
these ocean actually, liners are so much different than cruise ships. I mean, they're not even.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
well,
not
that's
even,
true. But here's the thing, Chief. What most people don't understand is that the reason that Bermuda, which is actually quite far north, I mean, if you look at where it is on a map, right? Bermuda has a very mild climate essentially all the time, and the reason is it's sitting in the middle of the Gulf Stream.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you get close to England, okay, you know, it's that kind of goes away. But yes, there's the ocean climate is not the same as, you know, what you have on land, on either side. It's just not the way it works.
If you look at, there's actually some stuff on YouTube. Talk about the difference between a cruise ship and an open ocean liner.
Oh, yeah.
It's quite
big
a difference.
Yeah,
I mean, one is point A to point B, regardless of the weather. I mean, if there's a hurricane, I think they probably go around a little bit now. But John was saying, to come over, they would have spots on the ship where you could get a radar shot of everybody around you.
Yeah.
He said the ocean is alive with ships.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you really got to dodge them. You're not dodging icebergs. You're dodging ships.
That's one of the things that, you know, people, it's the sea is so vast and thy boat is so small. Well, yes, the sea is so vast, thy boat is so small. However, there's a hell of a lot of them out there.
Yeah.
And, but from a standpoint of you being able to see them, the curvature of the earth means that beyond about 10 miles, you don't. Okay, now that's from sea level. You go up higher, you can see further. But when I had my 45... the radar, of course, was on the top. Duh, that's where you put it, right? But beyond about 13, 14 miles, even though I had plenty of power to be able to see further than that, you couldn't see. It didn't matter how big the vessel was. You can't see it because it's below the horizon.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the exception to that would be, you know, some military ship that's got masts sticking up, and the radar would see that.
Well, they used to see the smoke before they saw the ship.
Well, yeah, so I mean, like, you'd see, but you would see you would see a small return on the radar. It's not a small return. It's just that's the only part of the ship that's sticking up far enough that the radar can see it.
Well, these ocean liners, you know, there used to be, you know, but during the war, the original, the Queen Mary, the QE, original Queen, they came across, back and forth across the ocean literally hundreds of times. Those things were built so well, and they were they ran unescorted because they were so fast they didn't worry about torpedoes, which is weird.
Well, it's one of the things that's a reality of you know, just physics, is that the fuel cost of running at a higher speed is quite impressive. The thing with cruise ships is that cruise ships actually are diesel electric, and the reason they're diesel electric is that 80% of the load is actually from the hotel.
Okay.
It's not from driving the ship. Okay. Now at night, when everyone's sleeping and the galley's shut down, and you know, the everything else is shut down, all of a sudden the ship is 4 knots faster.
Well,
okay. Well, because they don't have to divert the power to the hotel. Okay, so they can use all of it to drive the ship. No traditional ship is driven that way. Traditional ships are all driven direct drive. There's no transmission. They actually start the engine in reverse to go astern.
Oh yeah.
And it's and that's just simply because every conversion in and every gearbox.
Actually, my old Chris-Craft speedboat had a transmission. You could, when you went in reverse.
Well, yeah, no, the smaller vessels do. Okay, my boat, you know, my boat did. I two Allison transmissions. An interesting note on that: those were originally developed for military use. They were essentially the same transmissions that were used in the landing crafts in World War II, and they were the only ones available in recreational craft. Of course, it wasn't designed that way originally. It was because they came from a military background, that were rated for full power shifts. So you could actually go astern with the engines at full power and not blow them up.
You didn't have to shift into neutral first.
Well, you went through neutral.
Okay.
But you didn't have to cut the power on the engines first. Okay,
all
so
right.
You could have the engines at full throttle and go astern. Now, if you did that and someone wasn't hanging on, oh, boy.
Yeah.
All right. But the thing, I mean, I never did that, but in an emergency, you know, where you actually had to, you could. With most transmissions that are in recreational craft, if you do that, there's going to be a bunch of pieces down in the engine room.
Well, yeah.
I mean, they're not going
to
take that.
You know, the railroad, I'll give this a quick one, and then we'll dash off to other subjects.
Yeah.
But the railroads are somewhat the same way. If you see a picture of an older train,
right,
like in the 50s or 60s, The first, I don't know if they had any of those still here when you were here in Chicago. Did they ever have any Northwestern cars that were painted and not stainless steel? Did you ever see one of those?
Oh, yeah.
Well, those were made by Pullman.
Yeah.
Okay, now what happened was the Chicago Northwestern was the first commuter line to show a profit. Now, the reason why they did that is because traditionally your locomotive would be on the front end. Don't call it an engine, it's a locomotive. Locomotive's on the front of it. They pull everybody in for the computer stuff, and the rest of the day they'd have to go out, back it out, and turn it around for the thing to go home.
Right, so screw that. They ran the other direction.
Well, so then they said, okay, we want push-pull trains where you can have a cab, right, essentially. But now, the original trains, all the locomotive did was give you, they call it traction power, which means you pull the damn train. Didn't know anything about the electronics. Every car had a system of generators and batteries. So when you were moving, it's like putting a generator on your bike, you know, for your headlight.
Right.
Very similar. And then there were batteries, so when you pulled into the station, none of the lights went out.
Stuff stayed on.
So now in order to go the other way, you needed what they call flow-through power. Well, then all of those cars were the first cars that had flow-through power, where the locomotive
you
was
had
out.
You had electrical connectivity.
And I think it... And it's really an amazing feat of electronics, car, because I think it comes off the locomotive at 660.
Well, and also, aren't they running 400 hertz?
Well, but whatever, I think the voltage is 660, and it comes down to 440.
Yeah.
But then your lights in the car are the same ones you'd have in your kitchen.
Right.
They're all 120. But if you ever see an electric box, one of those things, it doesn't look like yours in the basement, Carl. It's like some artist put it together. There's so many wires there, and they're folded absolutely perfectly. But the thing of it is, when you see a commuter train going by now, it has two locomotives on it, and say there's 10 cars. It's not like the locomotive needs help pulling the cars.
No,
it's all about the electrical.
Right.
And I'll ask you can be the only person that answers this question. When's the highest load for electricity? What kind of weather is the highest load for electricity for the cars?
Oh, I would bet it would be in the middle of summer because of the air conditioning. Wrong. Okay.
It's if it's like 45 degrees out, humid as all get out.
Oh, okay, because you have to get the humidity out of the car.
You got to turn the heat on, and then cool it, then get the humidity out, and heat it back up.
You got to run both cycles at once.
Yeah, you got to run both then.
Right.
Which doesn't happen very often. I mean, it's
makes sense.
It's a kind of a rainy, misty day in 45 degrees.
That makes sense. It's the same situation you have with an automobile that a lot of people don't realize is that your air conditioning compressor on your car runs when it's in defrost down to very close to freezing, and that's the reason. Otherwise, you can't defrost the front window.
I bought a Toyota T100. I'm driving it back from Florida, right? I'm in this hellacious rainstorm, so I got the defrost on, everything's steaming up, and the thing's barely working. It was like my car's from the 60s, right?
Yeah.
And I'm going, wait a minute, I know what I got to do.
I hit the
AC on. It didn't do it automatically. As soon as I turned the AC on, everything cleared off.
Yeah, well, exactly. But that's kind of where that is. So the last few days, did you see this Challenger report? Okay.
I think I heard, go through it for everybody. I think I heard bits and pieces of it.
Okay, so the Challenger report is basically it's not official government data, but it is a read on the internal strength of the job market.
Explain who those guys are. Everybody knows who ADP is now. Challenger Grant Christmas is a law firm that turned into this big. But if you fire somebody at your place and want to give somebody out, you know, kick them out benefits, generally you'll buy a day at Challenger Gray and Christmas, and they'll teach the person about the resumes and all that stuff. What exactly do they do now? Are they still a law firm? They still do all this other stuff?
I don't know if they're still a law firm or not, but they're kind of their salient product, if you will, that everybody knows about, is essentially the compiling how many people are getting fired, okay, laid off.
Now, how do they do that?
Well, that's a good question. It's like ADP. ADP comes out with, you know, they had their number out.
But they actually print paychecks for 45% of the business in the country, right?
Chief, you'd think if you printed paychecks for half the country, which they pretty much do, right? I mean, it's pretty close to half.
Well, they don't do government, so that's a big hole.
No, I understand that. But private sector, they are by far the largest.
By the way, do you think they do hospitals or somebody else does that?
Oh, no, they do hospitals.
Okay, sure. They do, okay. Sure. They do ours. I mean, so we use them.
Well, I know people in medical care if your paycheck comes from them, and I know people that, you know, do their own taxes on TurboTax or whatever, you don't have to have the actual W-2 because TurboTax will connect directly to ADP and get all the W-2 information.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's that, well, duh, Intuit is not stupid. They know that the majority of people that file taxes are getting their paycheck from them, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, and ADP has the data because they printed the paychecks. So you don't have to wait for the W-2 and key in all the data yourself. You have your statement. It has a control number on it. You put that in there, and it goes and gets it from ADP. So it takes 10 seconds, and it's got all the fields, so you will not screw up and make a math mistake and then, you know, end up getting a correspondence audit because what you have doesn't match what the IRS has got. But, yeah, so the thing is their stuff comes out, and they point out that, oh, by the way, in small businesses, the people are getting fired like crazy, okay? And yet in medium and large, there's still some ads going on. And oh, by the way, the biggest place the ads are going on is in healthcare, which I've been talking about that one for years now.
I mean, overhead healthcare.
and by the way, they're not doctors and nurses.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I wouldn't be, you know, if you think about this, Chief, there is no possible way on the planet, given the prevalence of this, that you need a doctor and a nurse for every one for every six people.
Right.
Okay? Yeah. I mean, that's that's nuts. All right. Yet that's
The University of California college systems have 10 indirect for every professor.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's essentially, I mean, it's my best guess in the healthcare system generally is that when you put 10 people into work, between 8 and 9 of them are screwing you out of money. One of them is actually poking and prodding and trying to figure out what's wrong with you.
Well, I mean, to explain it in a factory sense, when you're making railroad cars, everybody who's welding, wiring, electric, doing something, they're considered direct. Other people aren't. People like me sitting in the office,
Guy in the office running analysis is an indirect. Yeah. Is an indirect employee, right? And the people that are trying to collect the
money.
And
engineering and those kind of places, they could be considered indirect too.
To a point.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the guy that's putting the new air conditioner on the expansion on the roof, yeah, he's indirect because he's not actually producing railroad cars. Okay.
So if you wanted to get, that's when you get these, that's why I keep talking about, I don't know if anybody knows the hell I'm talking about, I keep talking about overhead rates. I haven't heard that term other than from me in 30 years, but whenever if you sit there and say, okay, I'm building a plane, I'm building a railroad car, I'm building a car, whatever it is, I'm going to have, it's going to cost me, you know, 1,000 labor hours, which it could very well be, building a railroad car. Might be more than that. It might be 1,500. I'm going to say, okay, and my labor rate is $40 an hour. What is my overhead rate? Is it twice that? Is it 1.5 times that? And generally, the firms that got over 1.5, 1.75 times that usually ended up out of business, right? I mean, you couldn't accept if you're involved in government or something like that.
Well, there's an imputed thing that you really can't get past, right, without running into big problems. So, yeah.
I mean, you have to have your people have to be able to sort of police themselves, and you have an inspector every five things or something. But if every time somebody's welding something, you got two idiots standing there watching them, that's a problem. Yeah,
Unless it's government, then all of a sudden that's the standard. So but the so anyway, the Challenger number comes out, the ADP number comes out, and you know, of course, we're getting the actual NFP number. You know, the official government number is late because of the shutdown, and you know they didn't collect the data.
It was the 16th, right?
Yeah, so I mean, it's, you know, the Fed
after the Fed meeting, convenient
after
right?
The Fed meeting. Okay, now. The thing is that if you look at where all of this is really going right now, you were talking about NVIDIA's CEO that's running around, oh, you know, we're going to lose to China if the government doesn't support us doing this. Okay. Mr. NVIDIA is, if he's sleeping well at night right now, given you know what he thinks is going to happen, he's got rocks in his head, and it has nothing to do with whether or not the company will survive, because it will. That's not the problem. The problem is, as I've pointed out, when you start running gross margins in the area where he is, you're going to attract a lot of people that are going to shoot at you, and they are.
Oh, they are, for sure.
They have, and they are. And his IP protection on CUDA is gone. Now that was the moat, the only moat they had, and it's gone. So now the problem he's got is Google has said, we've had enough of this predatory pricing crap. If you guys think we're paying double for compute capacity over what, you know, it would be in a commodity marketplace, you're smoking funny stuff, and it's not legal, okay? And so he's getting shot at now by God and everybody. AMD's after him, Intel's after him, Google's after him with their own chips, their own silicon, with the tensors that they're running in their phones, and all these guys are coming after him. Now, does that necessarily mean that they lose? No. It does mean, though, that margins are going to come down. And the other problem you have
He obviously didn't price the thing in such a way where people don't want to come after him. He priced it high.
He priced it extremely high. Okay, yeah. Now that has been very good for his stock price for, you know, for the last couple of years, right? Especially, right? If you look at the chart, it's, you know, the last, you know, 2-3 years has been absolutely spectacular, straight up. All right, problem with that is the equity value in a company is a levered bet on operating margins, right? When you think about it, I mean, it's what it is.
Well, it should be on returns, but nobody gets returns anymore.
Nobody pays dividends, so it's right. And then the other problem you have is that nobody, and there's been a few people that pointed this out, and so have I, but not very. Nobody wants to talk about this one either. The other problem you have is that all the stock-based compensation, and this is this, you know, Tesla's doing the same crap, right, with this, you know, $1 trillion pay package for, you know, for Elon. The problem with that is that there's only two, the only realistic way you can do that is to dilute the hell out of the shareholder, the common shareholder, all right? That's not being accounted for. It is technically, but the...
Well, you're also never going to pay a dividend, which is bizarre.
Well, but the way it's accounted for in GAAP is it's they are not breaking the law, in that the law says you have to do it a certain way, and they are doing it that way. So they're not doing something that, you know, would land you in prison, but it is misleading to the person who's out there that's trying to figure out the valuation of the company, because over that vesting period, the dilution is massive.
Oh, yeah. Hey, we got to dash off the break. We didn't do the first one. We'll be right back. Hold that thought. We're going to go quickly. SP Futures up 3, NASDAQ Futures up 25. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tamar, Ricky on the board, and it's cold day. The next time I'm going to have to take a picture of Ricky on a day like this, and I said, what are you going to do when it really gets cold? He was all trussed up. He looked good. I mean, I could see two eyes. That was all I could see this morning. SP Futures up 2, NASDAQ Futures up 23. Individual stocks, nothing kind of crazy. Netflix is down 4.5. They cut some deal here with Discovery. Everything else, nothing really bizarre. Caterpillar up 295 over in Europe. Real quick, DAX up 209.9%. They've been bullish the last couple days. FTSE up 4, call that flat. CAC around up 21.2, so the DAX is the outlier there. Asia, Nikkei down 536, that's a full 1%. Hang Seng up 149.6%. Shanghai up 27.7. So those guys continue to go different directions seemingly every day. Bonds up 1 basis point, 4.12. The Bund up 1 basis point, 2.78. Oil, right around 59.61 a share. Every day it's the same spot. Gold, we get a little rally out of gold here this morning. Up 19 bucks, 42.62. And $1.18 up on silver, 58.68. Big move in silver, 2%. Foreign exchange, the dollar's been down 9 days in a row, but not today. It's the other way, but still, the euro is the same spot, 116.5. British pound, same spot, 133. So they were lower a little last week. So the dollar has been, I won't say crushed. It's come down a little bit the last week, maybe 1%. Crypto down $1,400. Bitcoin back down to 90,841. So a lot higher than the 80,000 it traded a week ago, but still below the 126. Ricky, real quick, traffic, weather, sports.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:39 a.m. here in Chicago. 18 degrees right now with a high of 29. Breezy and cold today with intervals of clouds and sun. Tonight will be breezy as well with a low of 26 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 44 degrees right now with a high of 66. Tonight mainly clear and chilly with a low of 43 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Iman Kennedy from Monroe, 17 minutes. 31 minutes, Iman Edens from Lane Cook. Iman Eisenhower from Wolf, 34 minutes. We do have heavy traffic eastbound from the first all the way to Central Avenue. Dan Ryan from 95th, 29 minutes. And lastly, Stevenson from 24th, 32 minutes. Let's do sports. Blackhawks win 2-1 against LA Kings yesterday. Jump into the top of the wild card race in the Western Conference. Lions beat Cowboys 44-30 with 3 touchdowns by Jahmyr Gibbs. And this Sunday, we got Bears visiting Packers at 3:25 p.m. And at the same time, we got Cardinals playing Rams at home. showing up at the very bottom of the NFC West with a 4-loss streak. So good luck to Phoenix this Sunday. Lastly, NBA Bulls host Pacers tonight at 7 p.m. Number 3, Josh Giddey, has a 9.2 assists per game, so it's definitely a player to watch. At the same time, Suns at Rockets, 7 p.m. That's all I got for you, Chief. Back to you.
So, yeah, Carl, what are you going to – you're a man. What are you going to make of this next ADP number?
Well, what I take from the ADP number is that the strangulation of small business is, you know, is the trend that has been there for quite a while in their data and in the BLS data. Okay, so it's in both, and ADP seems to have a problem actually correlating to what the BLS reports, and since they actually just have to count checks. Either they're deliberately lying and twiddling knobs in order to make their numbers sound like what the BLS does, even though they then miss by crazy amounts, okay? So even though they do that, take the government out, they should not miss, but they do. Or the whole thing was a knob-twisting exercise, because I used to make jokes about them all the time when I did, you know, the monthly reports. I remember doing the jobs report ticker for the last 15 years. And it goes all the way back to when I used to monitor it when I was running MCS. So you know, we're at almost 30 years now worth of this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet correlation, forget about it. All right, I mean it's all over the place. So someone's full of crap. I've always called the BLS numbers the Bureau of Lies and Scams, because if my comparator is somebody who is actually just counting paychecks, I would think that that number is probably the right one.
I don't. Yeah, you know you mentioned it. But Dr. Jane,
here's the thing, Chief. There's a serious intermediate and longer term problem with what you're seeing with the small business stuff. Okay, and you know Hal and I have talked about, you know, Hal's come up with this thing with the split, which by the way I've talked about a little bit too.
You and I have talked about that for 10 years, 6 years
We've
now.
We've been talking about it for a long time.
But smaller people don't have access to capital like the bigger people.
Well, and it is to a large degree because of the things that were done after the crash in 08.
That's one way of looking at it. It either was the people want to do it anyway, use that as the opportunity to do it.
I'm not talking about the motive, clearly.
Yeah.
If you can stomp on your competitor by making it impossible for him to borrow, well, it's not impossible. He only has to pay 20% and you pay 4%.
What did your buddy Rahm Emanuel say? Never waste a good crisis.
Well, yeah. So I mean, but the thing is that and the Bernanke crap with setting the reserves to zero, which was a one liner he got stuck into the TARP bill. I reported on that at the time it happened. Nobody thought it meant anything. Yeah, okay, that was a load of crap. But here's the other interesting thing that's going on. You know, everyone's rate cuts. All year. From like the end of February, start of March, which, of course, is when Trump's administration actually started to, you know, get some cleats on the ground, right? Because, you know, you come in at an inauguration day, it takes you a little while to get your cleats on the ground and actually start doing what you're doing. All year, the 13-week 10-year spread has been trending, mildly, but trending, from the lower left to the upper right. I've got a one-year chart of it up on my screen right now while we're talking.
Well, I just mentioned something earlier. The last three rate cuts at 10 years, the same spot.
Well, yeah. But the thing is that steepening is a significant problem for people who can't play the bank credit game, because I've seen in the last couple of months... Okay, I have a number of friends of mine that are engaged in small businesses of various sorts. And I've also seen a number of them around here that have gone under. All right, there's just a local eatery that just blew up a few days ago. And actually a place that I sort of enjoyed, and they just, you know, the numbers weren't there. Now, they made some operational mistakes, and they probably deserved what they got because, you know, sometimes when you do things that piss people off, you don't come back from it. It wasn't environment, it was pricing. And they got quite a few people rather annoyed with them, myself included.
Well, they did the wrong thing. They raised prices or cut the portions, but if your expenses go up, what are you supposed to do?
Well, actually, they did both on the beer. They cut the size of the glass and raised the price. Okay, and oops, right? I mean, you know, and no, I understand. I mean, if your costs go up, you've got a problem, right? I mean, somehow. Well,
there's a pizza joint here in Chicago, just went 120 years.
Yeah.
And the lady said from her great grandfather, she remembered, don't ever cut the quality.
Yeah, well, you know, but the thing is that they, you know, it is what it is. They went under. But the thing is that you look at these things and some of the deals that I've seen, these smaller businesses, you know how they're getting around some of the people screaming about interest rates now? You're going to love this, Chief. You get this offer from a financial institution you've been doing business with. So they have a pretty good idea what your cash flow looks like because, you know, money's been going through them, right? All right. Now, they don't know what your operating margin is, but they know what your cash flow looks like at the top line. And you get this offer from them, $20,000 unrestricted, you know, use it for whatever you want within your business purposes. Oh, by the way, there's an upfront fee. So it's not like an operator. So, like, you know, I used to get these deals pitched at me all the time by the banks that we did business with when I was running MCS, where, you know, it's basically a revolver, okay, essentially. All right, fine. But, you know, the reason I told them all to go to hell is we're C Corporation and they want personal guarantees from me.
Well, that's what they're doing a lot of the Dodd-Frank stuff.
Well, I understand that. Yeah. Okay, but they want, you know, this was before Dodd-Frank, well before that, right? And I told the folks at the banks several times, you know, they got a middle finger back from me on that. I'm like, look, you guys have enough information, and if you don't, you can certainly do your diligence on it, that the cash flow, the cash position, and the hard assets within the corporation are enough to back what you're trying to pitch here, all right? Yeah, well, but if you believe that, this has nothing to do with what I believe with. You guys are the ones with the superior information. So don't give me this crap.
Well, I told you a story about my buddies that did the three or four houses on their own, and the fifth one, they couldn't, even though they had, you know, $1 million worth of stuff there, and only wanted to borrow $100,000, the bank say, no way, I want a personal guarantee. I mean, at some point, if it's 10 or 15 houses, then you can do whatever you want. I mean, that's a problem.
Well, the same thing happened when I was running the internet stuff, okay? But the thing is now what these guys are pitching is even worse than that, because what they're doing now is they're putting a upfront fee on this, even though you haven't drawn a penny of it yet, and it amounts to a 20% interest charge.
Well, you know, are you old enough to remember the compensating balances? They got you to the same place.
Well, yeah, but Chief, think about what happens. Yeah, I mean, how many small businesses have an operating margin that's sufficient to be able to cover that?
Not very many.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, I look at that kind of a bit. Now, it's one thing if I'm being charged the interest while the line's out, right? While the cash is actually out. Because, you know, operating lines in many cases are one of those deals that you need it right now because you got to make payroll, and next week a large customer's check is due for something you sold them. Okay, so there's a gap there, but the funding path is known, and the amount of time during which you're paying the interest is quite small because it's not drawn out for any great period of time. This is an upfront fee, so once you pay it, you now have to have the operating margin to be able to cover that on the back end. I look at these kinds of deals, and like I said, I have a couple friends of mine that are running small companies and have been pitching these things, and they asked me what I thought of it, and I looked at it, just got the calculator in and said, you're out of your effing mind if you take that deal. All right, go line up for the bankruptcy court downtown in Knoxville. Well, just do it now.
When interest rates were higher, if you had, like Pullman had 10 banks in their credit group, their lead bank was Mellon. They did a lot of stuff overseas, export-import banks, so, you know, Pullman was a very seriously high-rated place.
Oh, yeah.
But if you want to be in the credit thing, and somebody might have, say your total credit is $50 million. Well, Pullman's is buying probably that much at least. I mean, for all the stuff they did, payroll and everything all over the places. Well, if somebody was in there for $2 million, you might have to have a compensating balance of $100,000 just deposited at that bank.
Right.
You know, it was always just in a demand deposit. Now, if you think of the times where you could get 12% anywhere. So actually, the $100,000 was a $12,000 charge, really, right?
Right, right, right.
It was the same thing. But get back to the ADP thing. Right? Yeah. Dr. J and I used to argue about this all the time. When ADP first started doing this, and they didn't match the other, and John kept saying, they got to do something to match up, or it's a crappy point. So, John, why don't they just put out what it is and let the rest of us interpret it to our heart's content, and I don't need them to adjust it. Just tell me. 50% of the people in the country, you lost 30, you picked up 100. Just tell me. Let me worry about matching it up with the BLS. I don't want you guys to adjust it so you're going to try and match up, or where am I wrong here?
Well, it's the thing is, why do you enable, which is what it is, why do you enable the lying by the government?
And just put it out there. I mean,
just put the data out there and your methodology, and let it. And oh, by the way, if we got some actual pushback on the BLS garbage, you might actually see some improvements. Maybe.
Yeah. Well, but they scurried to try and match up with the government, which is crazy.
Exactly. What they did instead was, well, we got to go the other way. No, you don't.
Yeah, no, you don't. Hey, I was talking to Andrew and Wayne yesterday, talking about managing money and all the variables that come flying into the stuff, and these new variables, the politics and all the stuff, you know, the front running. To a certain extent, Kyle, really doesn't affect me all that much, because my guys are a little more of the long-term stuff, and you know, I really don't do day-to-day stuff, although since I was a minute-to-minute trader, every time I see, you know, the market in the crapper, and one of Trump's goons come out and say, oh, we're gonna lower the interest rates, and they fly back 800 points in 2 days, it's not really what I do for people, but I also feel that I sure could have sprinkled a few of those calls around people's accounts. It would have been nice. Nobody would have complained, would they?
Right.
So you still feel like you missed something. But out of all the times I've been doing this, this whole idea of good news is bad news, and the rallies we've had this week after this ADP number came out, if we came out tomorrow and said, on the 16th, we're down 4 million jobs or something ridiculous, does that mean the market goes up 10% that day because we're putting more money in, or we're going to become the Weimar? What? How far are we taking this bad news is good news crap?
Well, way further than we should. I think that's I think that is absolutely the reality of it is that, you look at things that like Elon and then the Nvidia guy are saying, 20% of your jobs are going to be gone to AI in the next 2 years, and half in five, right? Well, excuse me, people that are employed are the ones that pay taxes, right? For the most part.
Yeah.
Right. What are you proposing to do with the 80 million people you're going to displace?
But now we're not paying taxes.
Are you planning on shooting them? Because
the answer to that might be let them die. I don't know.
They won't go quietly. All right. So, I mean, you know, if you don't shoot them and you're like, well, let them starve, that's not how it's going to go down. They're going to go try to solve that problem through other means. Right?
Yeah.
You're not going to like the way that happens. And so is the answer kill them, literally? And if the answer is not kill them, then explain to me. Now, when the internet came in, all right, and word processing, before that, when word processing started, all right, the original ScriptSit and, WordPerfect and stuff like this, right? ScriptSit on the TRS-80s, WordPerfect on the DOS machines. Prior to that, a skilled typist made really nice money, all right, because it was a fairly high-skilled job.
Oh, sure it was.
And, well, yeah, because you had to use whiteout if you made a mistake with a word processor. You don't, plus you have spell check.
Believe me, I had to type term papers, and I was the worst. I was horrible at it.
Dude, I had one of them little Olivetti Underwoods, the ones in the little case. okay, which was what I had to use through high school and college to do term papers. All right, and yeah, I mean, I had a thing of whiteout in the tape, you know, that you put in there. To, yeah,
I must have known and, 20 guys that only had a girlfriend, not because they liked her, because she could type.
Because you're gonna, well, there you go. Well, I mean, I, you know, when so when I started doing programming, I, you know, I had a little bit of a leg up because I already knew how to type. But the but that job essentially, for all intents and purposes, you know, the secretary with a Selectric on her desk, for all intents and purposes. Now, I mean, there's still a few of them around, but for the most part, I mean, there was one in every office, right? For the most part, disappeared. Okay, fine. But those people then were banging keyboards on Compaqs and IBM PCs.
Yep.
All right. And so the job changed, but it didn't go away. And most of that got redirected. Fine. Now you're talking about literally throwing people out of, not the job changing, but the job disappearing. All right. Now there's already been some of this. All right. When I, you know, when I ran MCS, I wanted a live receptionist in my office as just as a customer service thing, because my belief is that that minor little level of human contact beats the call director. Press one for customer service. Oh, yeah. Press two for technical support. You know, da 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 da. Okay. Problem was, even back then, I went through those people because they would decide that on Sunday they were going to go out and party, and then they'd call in Monday morning and not come into work. Well, that meant I had to take somebody else off the floor and put them at the front desk, because someone's got to answer the effing phone.
But I think right? The part here that you're maybe getting to, maybe missing, if you're an electric company, you don't care. There's nowhere else to go.
Well, I understand that, but what I'm saying is that so ultimately, I essentially by the caliber of the workforce, even though, you know, let's face it, being a front end receptionist is not a particularly high skilled job, right? So it doesn't have a huge pay, but it's one that has to be done. Ultimately, I ended up putting a computer in, and I spent the money, even though back then it was expensive. And I did it because taking somebody who actually had a higher level of skill off the floor to put them on the front desk, that was a real hit to this productivity office.
How come, Colin, this is a question sometimes you ask, and we don't have much time, but I'll ask it both on a Pullman scale and on a government scale. I think everybody knows that typing on your computer is a hell of a lot better than somebody hacking away on a typewriter. Yet,
yeah,
with the treasurer's office, when I came downtown to Pullman to save me, of course everybody downtown got fired, how's that for saving people when they got taken over? But the treasurer's department was a guy named Kelly. He was an absolute character, but a brilliant guy. He liked me. Boy, if you liked him, you were good. But then he had Robin working for him, and Robin was drop dead brilliant in that area, and this other guy who was not the same. And he had this lady who was a secretary, assistant Evelyn, who 2 days a week would be in my office half hour going over her bowling scores from the night before. I'm going to say those four people, with all the primitive crap that they used, any company today that has a treasurer's office, I mean, don't forget Pullman Kellogg, Pullman Swindell, they were all part of Pullman in those days.
Right.
I'm going to say those four people, with the export-import bank and everything, did more than anybody's treasurer's department today with all the modern conveniences. And you'll read stories in the government about how Speaker of the House in 1958, with 15 essentially housewives that wrapped out the bills of using mimeograph machines and typewriters, how they produced more bills in a 2-year period than they do today. And now the Speaker has like 100 people working for him, or 80 people or something. I mean, I'm not saying you want to go back to that. I don't want to go back to the buggy whip or the thing where you had to crank your motor to get started, but we should be so far down the road in efficiency, and we're just not there, I don't think, are we?
Well, in some...
Is it the people themselves? What is it?
In some aspects, yes, there is, but in other aspects, there's not, and some of this is just, you know, some of it's just crazy. And the idea, though, that we're going to just take all of this... We're just going to take all this. It isn't going to matter. It's all going to be fine, and you know, it's it, or The other alternative is from, you know, from Mr. NVIDIA's point of view. That's not my problem.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's maybe that's the other answer, right? Is that he doesn't care. He made his money. He doesn't give a F what happens, to everybody else. Well, I got news for you. Your office doesn't stay standing, nor does your factory, if you take 50% of the employment in the country and destroy it. All right. Now, my read on this in reality is that that's not what's actually going to happen.
I would agree with that.
I think that's hype intended to boost his stock price, and it's not truth. However, that nobody who has heard this, all right, because I mean, he's running all around CNBC and everywhere else, you know, where are the people who are not just stenographers that would stand up and say, excuse me, we have, 160 million employed, a little more than that, actually, in the United States, per the BLS, all right? Now, maybe, their data is not perfect, but, this is what it is. I mean, it's 163 million as of the last report that we actually got. You're saying we're going to cut that down to 85. What are you going to do with the other 85?
Yeah, what are you doing? are they all over 65? Are they retired, or what are they doing? Are they going someplace?
Well, they're clearly not, right? Because that's because the definition of that is non-institutional 16 plus, right? So, what is it that you plan to do with all these people that you're displacing? And oh, by the way, they stop paying taxes. Exactly how do you think they're going to eat?
Oh, I know.
Maybe what they're going to eat is you.
Well, it was so funny. Evelyn would be in my office, right? And which is right next to Kelly's. He had the big corner office. All of a sudden, I hear him bellow, Evelyn, how did that asshole ever get in here? So the letter would go out. We really much enjoyed your business, but at this time, we cannot use your service. or she'd say, that guy wasn't bad. And she'd reschedule it. He had like four words he'd tell her, and all of a sudden, this really nice letter would come out. Looked like it was coming from the White House.
But yeah, I mean, I just see stuff like this, Chief, and I go, what in the F are you talking about, right?
Oh, I know. It's a crazy world, but... I mean, sometimes in our haste to get more efficient, at the end of the day, are we producing more per week than we used to? Even though it's easier for everybody, the answer might be no.
Well, that's, yeah. And the thing is that the, you know, when you look at the pull forward in the changes, as I pointed out back when we, you know, when we decided that we were going to get involved in this whole Russia-Ukraine thing, we destroyed the capacity for our government to issue about $450 billion a year worth of credit and not have it show up in the inflation numbers because it was being sequestered in overseas trade.
Hey, real quick, we got a dash. We'll talk more about it on Tuesday. The stuff Hal's identified and you identified, but the medical stuff, you know, God, we can fight about that forever. Not fight about, but talk about it. What are the chances of somebody in Washington on either side of the aisle saying, we're actually screwing these people. We need to change both the Dodd-Frank and this... What was the other act you're talking about? The Greenspan snuck the other one in the...
Well, that was... it wasn't Greenspan, it was Bernanke. The zero interest rate.
No, yeah, but what was the act? He pieced it into one... What act?
The TARP bill.
Yeah, so what are the chances of either one of those getting changed in our lifetime?
You know, I don't know, but the problem is that it's on the spending side when you get down to it, and unfortunately, the reality is that from the latest MTS, exactly what I predicted was going to happen now has, and within CMS, that's gone vertical. Now, if that's not immediately stopped,
by the way, when you predicted it, nobody argued.
Actually, everybody did.
I
back
didn't.
When I did, everybody said I was an effing lunatic.
Well, because they thought somebody would notice it and change it, but that didn't happen.
Well, but I said, look, you know, the reality is that here the trend is obvious even now. Why would you not stop it now? The easiest time to take the pain is when it's the smallest, right? I mean,
well,
you know,
yeah.
So
well, yeah, but.
Well, but that's not the way it works.
That's
right?
Not the way it works.
Well, and I'm like, look, I got this data that goes back several years. Nobody is willing to do anything to address it. I have to assume at that point, I'm not the only one who sees it. Therefore, my assumption is it's not going to be addressed until it blows up in our face. Well, here we are, and it's blowing up in our face. So
we don't fix stuff until we. What did Churchill say about Americans? They finally
we'll
go
do the right thing after we've tried everything else.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, have a nice weekend, bud. SP futures down 25 cents, so we were up. No, we're not. NASDAQ futures up 8, so it's kind of a mixed bag here. We'll be back on Monday. Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.